friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. And our friend, and indeed somebody who we've known forever, is he is a novelist. He is a political historian, a foremost chronicler of New York City. His bio, friends, when you have time, you might read it, because it is it's amazing. But let's go back, if we will, which is now some 30 years ago, believe it or not, to a time when author Peter Quinn was a speechwriter for, among others, Mario Cuomo. Or was that actually, first of all, you're very welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Adrian. Thanks. It's great to be back.
Okay. Governor Carey.
Yes.
Mario Cuomo, the, you know, the New York of a different era.
Right.
To be in that position of actually speechwriting for the governor of New York, apart from the fact, let's get away from the honor of it, that must have been a huge and enormous task. Now in hindsight, how did you handle it?
Well, I would say, there's certain things nobody in life sets out to be. One is a hooker or vice president of the United States or a speechwriter. You kind of fall into it. And I was at Fordham University getting a PhD in Irish history. I was actually the graduate assistant to Morris O'Connell, a great-grandson of Daniel O'Connell. And I was, just finishing up, and I was looking towards permanent underemployment, and I started writing for America, the Jesuit magazine. And Dr. Kevin Cahill read one of my articles and gave it to you, Carey.
Yeah.
And I got a phone call out of the blue. They were looking for a speechwriter. They said, do you want to write the Fordham School commencement speech? Now, if I know what I knew now, I probably would have said no, but I didn't know anything. So I said, yeah, I will, and I wrote it, and they liked it. And then I wrote the John Jay commencement speech. This is in 1979, and then they offered me the job. So I thought I'd do it for a year and go back to academics, and then I stayed with Governor Carey, 3.5 years, and then Governor Cuomo, and then I went to Time Inc. and Time Warner, and suddenly it was 30 years later. I never got back to academics.
Right. Friends, our guest is Peter Quinn.
But it was a great lesson. You see, one thing, I always wanted to write. I thought I wanted to write. But I would write when I felt like it. And then one day I found I'm suddenly on 55th Street in the governor's office, and I have to have a speech in 3 hours, and there's no excuses. I can't say, well, I need another 2 hours. And I suddenly learned the discipline of writing, that it doesn't matter if you're inspired. It doesn't matter if you have a cold. It doesn't matter if your back is out. You just got to knock out the product. It's hard work. That's what writing is.
And that does not change, again, the spontaneity. You are actually speaking through, through the governor. And you got to get it right the first time.
Well, I had the advantage of you, Carey, and Mario Cuomo, both very, very sharp men who knew what they wanted and were very articulate, and it was a great experience to work for them. It was a great discipline. I learned a lot. And I also learned about, and I think this helped me write novels, is, speechwriting is not writing a magazine article. It's writing for the ear, and so you're almost learning to write dialogue. You're learning to make people listen to what you're saying. It was all these accidental lessons that I picked up along the way. I mean, I never started out to be a speechwriter. I never started out to be a novelist, but I kind of stumbled into these things. I just did an interview with Commonweal, and they gave a great title to it. Your job is to show up. That's what I would say about a writer. The discipline of writing is you have to do it on schedule. You can't do it when you feel like it. I still write 2 hours a day. I have all day now. I'm retired. I'm no longer Time Warner. I've been retired for 5 years. But you can only write a certain amount each day, I find, and then you're exhausted, and then you've got to do something else. Not like you have 12 hours, you write 12 hours.
Novelist, political historian, and indeed somebody whose track record in terms of, we were talking to you about the discipline of writing. Is there a day or is there a time when you say, you know, I'm going to take a week off from this, or is this part of your daily routine?
It's, when I was writing, when I was working, I got up at a time when I decided I wanted to try to write a novel. I had never written a novel before, and I used to tell a friend of mine, you know, I can't find the time. He had written a novel. He was pretty successful. He said, would make the time, and he kept telling me that make the time, which used to really annoy me because he was divorced and his kids were grown and I was working full time. I had two kids, and then I finally figured out what he was saying, that nobody was going to hand me the time. So I started, I wasn't a morning person. I started to get up at 5:30 and write for 2 hours before I went to work. And I did that for 17 years. And it, you know, it came down to that, to being at the desk and write. I didn't write on weekends and I didn't write at nights. So my kids never knew I was writing a novel. And, you know, I just kept it to myself. And, of course, 17 years I did 2 books that way. But now I'm retired. And I find I show up every day to write or read or research. And you never know what you're going to get. Some days you get 1 page. Some days you get 2. Some days you get nothing. Some days you think you've written well, and then you read it the next day and it's terrible. It's a matter of persistence, I find. When I first started to write a novel, I really thought, you know, this is like a cavalry charge. You go up the hill, you finish the book. And then I realized it's trench warfare, like inch by inch every day. But the magic of it is if you do it, if you persist, if you just do, if you work half the 180 days a year and you get 2 pages a day, at the end of the year you have 360 pages. You know, it's the accumulation.
Yeah.
I always get, you know, I remember working with people and they'd say to me, oh, you know, when I retire, I want to do what you do, right? And I used to just laugh because they sounded like it was going to be a relaxing activity.
Right.
It's hard work. I don't know how the romance of writing ever developed because it's very isolating. You know, you have to go off by yourself for long periods of time. You have to do a lot of research, and then you have to sit down and pound it out.
And you have to turn it into a story. You can have all the research in a way.
That's the other thing, you know. It's really interesting to me because the guy who sat in back of me in English class in Manhattan College in the Bronx was James Patterson. So, you know, I always say, I was at an alumni event in Manhattan and said, together Jim and I have sold 150 million books worldwide. He sold 149,957,000. I've sold the rest. But Jim's books are really, he starts out with a plot and writes the plot. I never start with a plot. I am with the reader. Every book I've written, 4 novels, has started with a conversation. I'm listening to a conversation with people. And then it grows out of that. And I actually follow the characters. This latest book, Dry Bones, I came across an incident that was intriguing. I was reading a biography of William Donovan, the Irish-American lawyer and general who founded the Office of Strategic Services, which is the forerunner of the CIA. And I'm reading this biography, and I read about a failed mission of OSS agents in Slovakia in 1945. They went in to try to rescue flyers who'd been shot down, and they were caught by the Germans. And it just set my imagination off, and I suddenly was listening to a conversation. And then I followed the plot, and, you know, I didn't know where it was going when I started. And that was true. This is the 20th anniversary this year. In March will be the 20th anniversary of Battered Children of Eve, my first novel. It's been in print 20 years. And, you know, I remember the kind of magic of writing a novel was I suddenly was listening to these two characters in a bar on Catherine Street in Lower Manhattan. And that's where it began. It was I didn't know where it was going. You know, 10 years, I didn't finish it for, took a long time, but I just followed these characters. And I always say part of writing a novel is brooding. You do a lot of research, and then you sit on top of the research. When my daughter was young, we lived in Brooklyn, Park Slope. I used to take her to the playground on Saturdays, and she came over to me one day. She was about 3 1/2. She said, "Daddy, are you sad?" And I said, "No, honey, I'm just brooding." And I was. I had these characters. I had this guy, Jimmy Dunn, in my head, and I was saying, "I don't know what you're going to do next." And, you know, it's a matter for me, and I don't think there are any rules in writing. I think everybody's got their own.
Right.
You know, thrill.
At what point, now, you developed this character, and at some point you have to know, or you've got to feel, God, I'm not going to be able to do this in one book. You don't get up one morning and say, I'm going to now create a trilogy.
Right, no, it's true. Yeah, I've written these, Arrow the Cat, Man Never Returned, Dry Bones. These are the three books.
Yeah.
I start with Arrow the Cat. I'm a big Raymond Chandler fan. I think he's not only a detective writer, but he's a great American writer. He didn't write mysteries. He wrote literature.
Yeah.
And I read and reread him, and I really loved Philip Marlowe, his character, but I always felt Marlowe belonged in New York. So I started to write this book, Arrow the Cat, and I was started with a single murder, and then I said, what about instead of a single murder, it's the largest murder plot in history. What about if it involves eugenics, which was the basis of the Holocaust? And
yes.
So then half the book is in New York, half is in Berlin. And I invented this character, Fenton Dunn, who I really liked. He was a composite of a lot of people I knew, cops and court officers and people I grew up with in the Bronx. He's a hard-edged kind of guy, cynical but not without ideals. William Kennedy has a wonderful expression, cynical humanism. He describes his Irish-American characters in Albany, and that's what I felt Fenton Dunn was. So I didn't feel like it was finished with him after the first novel. And then I got this idea for a book about this famous disappearance in New York, August 6, 1930. Judge Joseph Force Crater of the New York State Supreme Court got in a cab on 45th Street. He was never seen again, nor the cab. So my editor said to me, well, why don't you put Fenton Dunn on the case? Because I was going to write a history. I said, yeah, that's a really good idea. And he said, now, why don't you make it three books? You know, you can do Fenton Dunn's whole life. I said, that's a great idea. And so I did that. Man Never Returned did well. And then Dry Bones. But I wrote them. It's a trilogy. But I wrote them so you don't have to read them in order and that they each one stands on their own. You don't have to read all three books to understand who Fenton Dunn is.
Right.
But if you do, you know, you'll get a composite picture of him from 1918 to 1958, which I try to make, in a way, these are history mysteries, but also because I have this, I can't get this historian out of me. I like to think that there's a social history of Irish American New York, you know, in those novels, that through his life you're seeing the outer boroughs, you're seeing the Irish come up to the civil service, you're seeing the difference that the First World War and the Second World War made to Irish assimilation. His interactions with a guy like William Donovan, who, you know, Donovan's grandparents came in the famine, moved to Buffalo. His grandfather was a Fenian, and he then enters the highest levels of WASP society in America. He goes to Columbia Law School and joins a big law firm, becomes very wealthy, marries a WASP, and then he interacts with Fenton Dunn, who's still this ex-New York City cop. So, you know, I love the interchange. I love writing the scenes between them because they're actually from the same background, but they're different ends of the social scale at this point.
Your peers indeed hold you in highest esteem, but, you know, when you find yourself, as you do many times with authors and writers, and particularly in the Irish-American field, you know, you're sometimes, and we have actually seen this, you know, you're like the Christ child in the temple. You're there, it's like, but you do have that magnetism, something that we associated long, long ago with, you know, with Pete Hamill. And now something developed out of this, in that finally, and you were the co-founder, you know, of the writers. What's the correct title?
Irish American Writers and Artists.
Yes, that must be a that. Well, we know that is a very cohesive group. But do you put a time limit on that? You know, say, hey, speechwriter, somebody working on deadlines, we can't kill a whole day here. Let's have a meeting for 90 minutes or something. How does that work?
Well, it's very interesting. The Irish American Writers and Artists came out of a Danny Cassidy who wrote How the Irish Invented Slang. He was a great character.
Yes.
He had a whole Irish organization in San Francisco, and he said, you know, we have all these Irish communities in New York and Boston and Chicago, San Francisco. We never talk to each other, and we have all these people writing and playing music, and, you know, there's no cohesion, there's no dialogue. So he it was his idea to start that, and then he unfortunately got pancreatic cancer.
Yes.
And myself and T.J. English and Ashley Davis picked up the ball and got it rolling, and we started this Eugene O'Neill Lifetime Achievement Award with William Kennedy and Brian Dennehy and Judy Collins at that. And the organization kind of took off. And I served as president for 3 years. But, you know, one thing I think is you shouldn't stay around too long. You have to make way for new people. So now T.J. English is president, and mm-hmm. I think he'll serve 3 years and then somebody else. Because we really don't want it to become like an established hierarchy. And this organization belongs to three people. It should belong to the Irish American community.
Yeah, but as an author, as a writer, it also establishes, you know, that unlike some other areas where there's a high level of competition, maybe that perhaps with musicians or playwrights or others, but there is a sense that you guys are very cohesive in the sense that it is in the positive light. It is an admiration society which has to be healthy rather than, where you actually sit in terms, are you, you know, number one on the list or that type of thing, I think, is
yeah, well, one of the purposes of it, and it's in the charter thing, is, you know, is to make room, it's to develop new voices, that it's not just to celebrate people who have managed to have their books published and enjoy some level of success, but trying to help people. They have these readings every at the Thalia every first Tuesday of every month where people can get up and read their stuff and encourage one another. I don't think we ever really had that in the Irish American community. And I know in my case, I mean, my parents had gone to college, but I was still my ambitions were the civil service. Nobody was going to be a writer or an artist. That was like
right. But if you were, you know, if you were, I think from the parental level or from, family circles, that would not have been considered as a, quote, day job. You know, this is a wonderful thing to do, provided it doesn't interfere with the day job. My God. imagine if, and that was done with great sincerity.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, it came out of their experience, you know. I think the great silence in Irish American life about the effect of the famine and as the founding event of the Irish American community and the whole accent on security and providing for your family and, you know, working. My mother, I never heard a bad word out of her mouth, but the worst curse word she ever used was a bum. And a bum was somebody who didn't go to work.
Right.
Work was the defining value at the center of everything.
Yes, and you could add to that
and
security.
And work meant real work. It meant being in a union or being in the civil service. It didn't include being a writer because that was like, what are you sitting up in your room on your ass?
I know, and also for immigrants. You know, your greatest advice is coming through the door was to guide you into that area of security.
Right.
You know, many of us feel that, you know, when you came and somebody said you have to get into you have to get into the telephone company.
Right.
You know, that had a ring to it.
Yeah.
You know, civil service, union protection or some of the established areas where we've had traditionally a great amount of success anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the other thing, you know, I went to Manhattan College, a lot of engineers. Con Ed was another.
Con Ed,
the telephone company. I had an Aunt Gertie, she was 46 years a telephone operator, and she actually retired with a nice amount of money.
I know.
You don't have that anymore, you know, that whole. But it really was, you don't want to gamble too much because it was in the people's conscience. They didn't talk about it, but I really think sometimes you don't have to be told a story to get the story. It's told to you in the way your parents told you and the expectations they give you.
Right.
And that was part of the culture that we grew up in, you know.
And those expectations, you know, was not low bar. They set,
oh, yeah.
You know, they really set a high standard, you know. And it was, I think, part of our culture was that the next generation should definitely do, you know, better than they did, which is
right.
Which is great. And you know, that helped, I think, a lot at every level.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we had a lot of time for the arts, and I think now for the first time, really, in this generation, there's a real blossoming of, you know, Irish-American talent in the arts, music, you know.
Film.
Colin McCann won the National Book Award, and musicians and actors, Brian Dennett. For the first time, we're really kind of flooding the cultural scene in America. We tended to be off in a corner on our own.
Right.
I mean, we're the one immigrant group. We established our own school system, parochial school system, our own hospital system, our own university system. Growing up in the Bronx, we had three Catholic colleges, Fordham, Manhattan, and no other immigrant group did that.
Right.
And we had the civil service. So, you know, it was the way into America, but we did it on our own terms, and we didn't do it perfectly, but I always say the amazing thing is we did it at all, given where we started.
But also, I think that the highlight on the Irish contribution, particularly now in the arts and so forth, that's infectious, and it just seems like each time we say, well, boy, this is, we've reached the pinnacle, we're actually moving in at rapid speed towards a pinnacle that we don't even know what.
Yes, I know. We're moving into a whole new phase where, you know, for better or worse, the influence where we defined ourselves really when I was growing up to be Irish in the Bronx was to be Catholic.
Right.
And the church was the center of everything. And for better or worse, that's no longer true in the next generation. And there's something lost there, but there's something gained, that there's a more accent on Irish culture, the music, the literature, the poetry, the dancing. That's becoming the definition of Irishness rather than religion.
And some would say not before its time, but I just wanted to, this your character, which again shows up in your final book trilogy of the trilogy, this Dry Bones, you actually take World War II and pretty much, you know, that became the initial focus. How do you switch from that? How do you incorporate other historical, as in both in fact and in fiction?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, I always felt about writing history, when I was studying history, if you're an honest historian, you have to stop with the facts. And no matter how many, the irony of history, I think, is most of it doesn't get written. You know, we think we know a lot of history, and actually most of it is off the books. It's just like writing the first book at the famine and realizing all these million Irish coming to New York. I don't have one letter, everything's in the shadows. So if you're an honest historian, you have to stick to the records and the facts. And if you're a novelist, where the facts end is where your real fun begins. So that was true in Banished Children, was true in Dry Bones. I started with this incident of guys being parachuted into Slovakia. And there's a lot that's not known about how these guys died or what happened or you know, the exact circumstances. So I could just kind of use my imagination. And one of the things that impressed me was I thought I knew a lot about the Second World War, and then I'm reading about Slovakia, and I'm saying, well, you know, I know there was a Czechoslovakia, but I wasn't aware there was a separate country called Slovakia. This is a, I mean, I was a history major, and that the Germans made the Czech Republic into a protectorate, and Slovakia became an independent country and an ally of the Germans, and it was under kind of a clerical fascist regime. It was the only Slavic country to do that, and it was sandwiched between Hungary and Poland, so that the trains, when the Germans deported the Jews from Hungary, 600,000 to Auschwitz, they had to go through Slovakia. So if Americans were in Slovakia, they would have been one of the few Americans to see these deportations and the people when Auschwitz is evacuated, the remaining prisoners are taken through Slovakia. So I could have these soldiers, American soldiers, see this. Now, I didn't have any record that this happened, but it could have happened.
Right.
Easily. So that's, you know, the fact history thing is, well, I start with the history and the facts, and then the facts end, and we'll never know exactly what went on. So that's where I can really let my imagination go.
The demise of many of, you know, the thousands of characters and falling again off the face of the earth.
Right.
Some would say that continues.
Well, it, you know, it absolutely does. I mean, you know, most human lives are not. That's the thing about a novel is the investigation of people who aren't really in history. Most of us don't really make it. We wind up with statistics. I started to look for my when I started banished children for my relatives come 1847 to New York, and I knew very little about them. And it was one of the reasons I wrote a novel was because I could find the addresses where they lived. I found, you know, the Marriott at St. Bridget's on Avenue B, and they moved here, and they did this. But there were no voices. There were no letters.
Yeah.
There were no – nothing had ever been told to me about them.
That brings us to, you know, the inherent, you know, sense of shame, an expectation that, you know, despite best efforts, that somehow there was this sense of failure, and this comes out of, you know, centuries of oppression. And we'd have to recognize that on both sides of the Atlantic, not just in Ireland. But here there was this kind of reluctance as well to say, you know, why dig it up? You know, and I think that was a barrier for many, many decades, and you can understand why.
Yeah, it was, and, you know, it was something not talked about, and I understand why it wasn't talked about, because people didn't want to burden their children. To be an immigrant was to start anew, and they wanted to leave that behind, and my parents or grandparents were never passing on us stories of they carefully censored a lot of things. I found out things later on about relatives who, well, he didn't really die of a heart attack. It was a much more, you know, he had been shot in Hoboken. But that was shameful. That was really part of it. They were reading that out of. So one thing that I do in my novels, you know, I'm mixing history, I'm mixing family stories, I'm mixing my imagination. And, you know, I get a great deal of enjoyment out of it. I mean, I think one of the most important occupations there is, and I've come to this conclusion, you know, I worked in a corporation for 23 years in politics, is a storyteller. And really what defines the human species is, you know, we started with fire and language around a campfire, and what held us together was stories. And there's no nation or religion or family that's not organized around stories. It's a very, very important occupation, putting things down, stirring people's imagination, giving people a common story to see not only their own ethnic history, but to understand what it is to be human. And part of this humanity, the generality of humanity and the particularity of being Irish is storytelling. And I don't think storytelling was more important to any other culture than the Irish, because, you know, the language was taken away, the land, We had no institutions to reflect who we were in our own country.
No recourse, you could add. You know,
and the people who preserved the Irish identity, when you look back, you know, it's you think about Yeats and Joyce, O'Casey, the way they put Ireland on the map in the 19th and 20th centuries. This little colony, English colony, is huge on the world stage, not because of its politics, but because of its storytelling.
Yeah. When that actually was and I still think we're good at it, in the sense that, you know, the oral history has played such a tremendous role in Irish history, and despite all of, you know, technology and the immense access there is now to all kinds of information, the storyteller,
yes,
still.
Yes. The Shanachie,
yeah.
But you know, that was the saving the identity of who we were under this tremendous colonial pressure to make us reflections of another culture, and this kind of insistence on asserting who we are and as human beings, and the particularity of our experience and the universality of it. That's all in those stories. I mean, you know, it's in Ulysses, it's in Yeats, it's in O'Casey, it's in Seamus Heaney, you know, his voice, his incredible voice, and it's not just it's a great Irish voice, it's totally rooted in Irish experience, but it's also a global voice.
And how, you know? First of all, again, let me, for those who are listening to us, the book, Peter Quinn's newest book, is Dry Bones. And, of course, your character, Fintan Dunn, there will be those who feel like, you know, you shouldn't really end with the trilogy.
Well, you never know. Somebody just mentioned to me a prequel. I said, that's really interesting. I've had Illumination Productions has taken an option on this, on the three books.
Right.
Trying to develop a television series. They essentially bought the character Fintan Dunn. It's an interesting thing because they can make all three books into movies or television, or none of them, but they have the character. They have an option to develop.
They surely do. The book, by the way, I just wanted to tell people, the book is Dry Bones, and it's Overlook Press.
Yes.
Overlookpress.com. And there is another website here, www.newyorkpaddy.com.
That's PADDY. That's my website.
Yeah. Paddy. PADDY. Paddy.com.
New York Paddy, yeah.
Now, I there is an event coming up at Glucksman Ireland House, and God, we really have been lucky to have Glucksman Ireland House, and to have that as a center for something we never even dreamed of.
Right.
But their annual gala this year, the honoring Pete Hamill, he's getting the Seamus Heaney Award for Arts and Letters. That promises to be a tremendous occasion as well, and the Lewis Gluckman Award for Leadership recipient Buzzy O'Keefe, indeed another great character, and you know Buzzy O'Keefe, a Wexford. He was actually born to a Wexford father and Tipperary mother. And I think worldwide he's celebrated Restaurateur now for the bulk of 50 years. Here's somebody who was amazingly affected, actually practically wiped out the compliments of Hurricane Sandy, and has just rebuilt both of his of his place, the River Cafe, and of course the Water Club. But again, somewhat of a symbol of the Irish. Knock us down,
Right.
Fine.
Yeah.
We'll
get
up
again.
You know,
what's also interesting is, like, Pete Hamill, you know, comes from the outer boroughs like I do, and Catholic education, and, you know, he's gone on to become an international literary reputation.
Right.
And Buzzy O'Keefe, I don't think we've ever noted for a cuisine, but he's pioneered that that area.
Absolutely.
In fact, I remember Frank McCourt saying, one editor said he didn't like the title Angela's Ashes because he said it sounds like your Irish mother's cookbook recipe.
By the way, that Glucksman Ireland House gala is taking place on Tuesday, February 25th, at 6:30, and it's co-chaired by Judith McGuire and John Sharkey. And you're on duty as master of ceremonies for that occasion, too.
Yeah, I did it last year. I guess they invited me back again. I don't know if that's good or bad. Maybe they couldn't get anybody else. But anything I can do, the incredible generosity of Loretta Brennan Glucksman, the amount of time and love and attention and financial support she's lavished on Ireland House.
Yes.
It's made such a tremendous difference, and it's such a vibrant place.
And also
on there all the time. Language, literature, history. You know, the lights are never out in Ireland now.
I know.
And it's really wonderful because of it's just its geographic situation. There it is on the right off Washington Square, like on Washington Mews, maybe the premier location in New York City for any academic institution. And there it is, you know, and it's there permanently. And it's thanks to Loretta and Lou Glucksman that it's there. It's a priceless contribution. And I think the entire Irish community is so indebted to them both.
Well said. Peter, Peter Quinn, good luck again with Dry Bones. Of course, this being the third of the trilogy, you have a built-in audience. You have many, of course, who were waiting for this to happen. But I think it's interesting that you say you don't have to read them in any particular order. You know,
yes. As long as I say, don't get them out of the library, buy them.
There you
go.
Thank
you so much.
Absolutely.
Okay,
again, good luck to you and Franz.
God
bless you. Thanks.
Okay,
Franz, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.